Welcome to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, the Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. In this episode, we talk about rural hospitals with Jay Anders, the Chief Medical Officer for Medicom Systems. He talks about some of the difficulties facing rural hospitals and how technology can help those providers. And he talks about some of the ways to help sustain and strengthen rural hospitals, which really don't get enough attention. It's a great conversation, so thanks for joining us. Well, thank you for joining the Healthy Bottom Line podcast. I'm your host, Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Today, we're talking with Dr. Jay Anders, the Chief Medical Officer for Medicom Systems. Dr. Anders, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Glad to be here, Ron.
Rural hospitals have had no shortage of challenges over the last few years, really even before the pandemic, but the pandemic has certainly only exacerbated the difficulties for many hospitals in rural settings. Do you view them as sort of a final or really sort of a neglected frontier when it comes to the healthcare landscape?
Well, in healthcare as well as healthcare IT, they tend to be overlooked, and they're really not well understood, the challenges that they have. And I'm talking about both providers and patients and their access to healthcare. I mean, it's kind of a struggle across the board.
Well, it's been difficult for a lot of hospitals. Apparently, there was a study that came out earlier this year that about half of America's rural hospitals are in the red. Again, that's only worsened over the past couple of years, which probably explains why they have some of the healthcare IT issues and maybe want to be able to investing in some of the digital solutions that they like to, because they're focused, frankly, on keeping the doors open. Do you see any signs of some light at the end of the tunnel for some of these rural hospitals, or do you think they're just going to continue to see more challenges?
Well, I hope there is some light at the end of that tunnel. There's been a lot of consolidation in the rural health field, meaning that smaller rural hospitals are being purchased by larger systems. That helps in one way and actually hurts in another. Looking at it from just a patient care standpoint, when that happens, a lot of the more specialized care that has been provided more rurally starts to move more centrally into larger cities. And that could be 90 minutes away, could be 2 hours away. And if you look at how patients' families are involved in patient care, it puts a real burden on a family when a loved one is in a hospital, it's 90 minutes drive to go see them and be with them. But then there's the whole idea of staffing of the hospital in and of itself. There's a great shortage of primary care physicians, and that's the largest number of physicians in rural areas are primary care. Specialty care really isn't available a lot in the rural setting, so it makes it more difficult to get that care. But the shortage, I mean, we need 20,000 new primary care people now. We're that far down. And when you've got, 90 million people living in rural areas, and you've got one tenth of the physicians practicing in those areas, it makes it really difficult to provide good care and what I would say more comprehensive care.
And there's been a lot of attention, rightly so, on the number of rural hospitals that have closed in recent years, well over 100 hospitals that have closed, I think, since 2010. But I think sometimes, and you've already alluded to this some, the other bigger thing is a lot of these hospitals, they're keeping the doors open, but they're ratcheting back the services they're providing. So, and that's forcing patients to do those 60, 90 minute drives. I mean, I live in the Northeast in Pennsylvania, so I'm a little spoiled in being able to get to most things within a half hour, 40 minutes. But if you're in the West, it is not unusual at all to have to drive an hour or more to get to your nearest provider. And that places a real burden for older patients or just patients with any healthcare issue whatsoever. Like you usually don't want to spend 2.5 hours just driving to and back from a provider if you have needs. So that just seems to be compounding an already difficult situation for these patients in rural communities.
Well, I'll give you a little example of a little bit of my background and where I grew up and how I've been involved with this. So I grew up in a town of 20,000, Central Illinois. When I was growing up in the little town of Jacksonville, Illinois, we had two hospitals, and probably around 350 beds in a town of 20,000. We had a full selection of specialties in that area. The care was good. Let's roll to 2024. There is one hospital that has about half the size that it was. It is now associated with a larger medical center that is, well, it's an hour away. The other hospital in town closed. The number of primary care physicians has fallen, and the specialty care has drastically been reduced. So that's my hometown. That's where I grew up. And as a medical student and resident, as well as my first part of my practice lifetime, I spent time going to smaller hospitals in central Illinois and seeing patients. The emergency rooms are understaffed. The hospitals are understaffed. So it's just a real issue in this part of the country about how we're going to provide healthcare. Not to talk about things like healthcare IT and how that could help, and there's several ways, but they have to have access to it. So staffing is down and care is not at the level it was.
And it just seems like it's going to continue. We think about rural America, it's if you're not from rural communities, it's sort of common to have the misconception that nobody lives in these rural communities. Like one out of five Americans lives in rural communities. So that kind of gets lost sometimes in these discussions. And part of the problem is there only one in 10 doctors is practicing in these rural communities. I mean, so it's not even matching the needs of the population in these communities. So, and do you see any chance of getting more physicians to practice, maybe even spend a few years in their career in these rural communities to start out before they move into rural settings? Or is it just not realistic to expect to get too many more doctors in these rural areas?
Well, I'll use Illinois. That's my home. Well, it was my home state. As an example, there are two fairly large medical schools in central Illinois. One is Southern Illinois Medical School. The other is a version of the University of Illinois. Both of those have programs now that are directed to primary care and that are trying to get medical students that will practice in a rural setting or a non-urban setting, I'll put it that way, to start to staff some of this. In addition to that, there are local nursing programs that are starting to ramp up with that same focus. Nursing's a little different because in the nursing world now, you've got what I call contract nurses who work for big corporations that are farmed out to these smaller rural hospitals for which they have to pay maybe three or four times what they pay for a staff nurse because of all the costs and benefits and everything else that they require. So there are programs now starting to take effect. And I have a nephew that's about to graduate from one of those medical schools that hopefully he will think about going into that part of the world and spending at least some of his practice lifetime. So yes, I do see some hope in that. And there are, this is not the only state that have these kind of programs. A lot of what I call the Farm Belt, the medical schools that are located at large land-grant universities, are starting to say, hey, we really got to start focusing on the constituency that we've had for years and get them back to something that is normal.
Well, the programs like you mentioned, other loan forgiveness programs, are starting to be utilized more and more. It just seems so like that's going to have to be a critical part of the solution, because doctors coming out of med school, they're coming out with over $200,000 in debt. I mean, they need to be able to earn money. And I'm sure that's probably a deterring factor for some of these folks carrying six figures debt, $200,000 or more in debt. Some of them are probably thinking, I need to go somewhere where I can earn a little bit more to get out from under this huge debt load. So it just feels like the loan forgiveness solutions are going to have to be a pretty big part of this for long term.
And the two programs I described for in-state residents are markedly reduced in tuition, as you would compare to one of the, like, say, the large Chicago medical schools. So there is that aspect that you come out with less debt when you're in one of these programs, as opposed to going to a Harvard or a Yale or a Stanford.
Well, we should be talking about technology because, I mean, obviously, this is something that folks have been saying can offer some answers to some of these problems. I mean, what, from your perspective, how can technology, information technology, possibly play a role in helping make sure we preserve these rural hospitals that clearly are needed in their communities?
One of the things that COVID taught us, and it's a good lesson that we've learned, is there's a lot of care that can be done in the telehealth mode, meaning you can be remote, but yet present. And there are now consultations with specialists that are telehealth consultations. They have virtual ICU rooms where there's cameras all over the room, all the monitoring equipment is set up, and you have qualified nurses on staff, but the critical care doc that is monitoring the care is actually remote. So it's a really great use of that person's expertise because he can monitor or she can monitor several more patients at one time, but still provide pretty good care. It doesn't negate somebody being in the hospital when you really need someone, but it does help bridge that gap. So when we talk about technology, there are two aspects of technology that I really It's one of my soapboxes. One is usability, the other is cost. When a small rural hospital gets absorbed by one of a larger hospital, they usually have one of the major vendors that cover healthcare IT. Those systems are hard to learn, hard to implement, and expensive. And depending on the financial arrangements they have when that acquisition occurs, they could be throwing the baby out with the bathwater, meaning that you've now got a system that's more technology, but unusable because it's not built for that rural setting. The good news is that there are companies starting to focus on this market that are starting to develop systems that are of lower cost, but high function, meaning they provide all the services that one needs to practice in a rural setting, but not at that massive cost. So I'm really encouraged when I see companies start to say, okay, this is the great forgotten marketplace for this. Let's try to create something they can use that's highly usable and not at a massive cost. So I'm hoping that that starts to take effect and people start to adopt these systems.
There's been so much talk about AI in healthcare. Yes, we are contractually obligated to mention AI in healthcare during this program. But I mean, do you see AI as potentially being another tool in the toolbox that can maybe help some of these rural hospitals or even some of the rural physicians in terms of using as a tool to support diagnosis or to offer better care that maybe they haven't been able to, even for a little bit farther away than otherwise? Do you see that potential?
Yes, I do. I think AI has a lot of potential. It also has some risk, and it certainly has some cost, which we really haven't delved into in the whole health IT industry very much. People are looking for that brass ring to grab as the merry-go-round goes around, and that brass ring may be made of gold that you can't afford. So that concerns me a little bit. But AI, in and of itself, there are uses of that technology that could certainly augment a practitioner, and we're seeing more nurse practitioners and physician assistants, which are well-trained people, but they're not seasoned physicians. There's a different level of knowledge and care. So it certainly could help them practice in a rural setting and assist them in doing some of the things they need to do. I'll say my biggest concern with AI is actually twofold. It's got to be more transparent than it is, meaning we got to know where the information's coming from and how it's been vetted. The other thing is the cost. We've really not figured out, okay, granted, I'm a rural hospital. I've got 45 beds and 15 physicians. I can't afford another $500,000 a year for AI, depending on what it gives me and what the return is. So we got to be careful. We've already taken the baby steps. The ONC has determined that we've got to get it transparent. Thus the HTI-1 and now HTI-2 coming out, a couple of regulations that everybody's kind of buggy about right now, which are all good things. So I'm really encouraged by the AI revolution. My concern is start to ask the people that practice medicine in those areas what they need from an AI system. Not what you think they need, what they need. So that requires people who develop these systems to go out and actually ask the providers of the care, what do you guys do? How do you do it? Can we assist you? What's the biggest pain point you have? Is it communication? Is it diagnosis? What is it? And start to focus some of this AI development to help augment the things that either clinicians don't want to do or take up a lot of time from patient care that they have to do. So if that makes sense, I'm encouraging all these developers out there in the AI world that say, okay, let's go out and let's develop solutions, but let's develop solutions that are focused on the care of the patient and the support of the physician, not some kind of one-off, oh, I can get a summary of this, or I can, you know, figure out this med does that. Because most of that kind of assistance is probably something they really don't need, or they don't need a very high percentage. So I'm really encouraged, yet I think we got to take cautious steps and start worrying about transparency and bias and the other things that AI has started to get us focused on, that before it's really widely deployed and assisting in healthcare, it needs to be looked at.
You mentioned the cost too, and it just reminds me of some conversations I had at the HIMSS conference a couple months ago, where people are really worried about the equity challenges of AI. And think, speaking of rural hospitals or like federally qualified health centers in urban communities, they don't want them to get left behind as some of these developments happen, in terms of especially the cost that you mentioned too. They even likened it to the situation with electronic health records, where they said, you know, the rural hospitals didn't get the help they needed with electronic health records, and talked about how they don't want to see a repeat as some more of these AI tools become available, even just on the administrative end. So is this something where the government just is simply going to have to do more and also do a better job to make sure that rural hospitals, along with some other hospitals in disadvantaged communities, aren't left behind?
Oh, absolutely. In talking with the folks at ONC, that's definitely on their radar. The cost, and if you talk to the AI developers, it's kind of interesting because, oh, it doesn't cost that much. It doesn't cost that much. Well, it depends. Don't tell me it doesn't cost that much. No one gets into this business for free. When you talk about all of these AI systems, they're not in it for free. So let's really start to look at the cost and see what it's really going to cost and what it actually does as far as return on the investment. I spend the money, what do I get? That really hasn't been developed all that much, especially in the rural system. I mean, it's these guys are struggling to provide basic care, and the last thing they need is a full-on AI analysis of somebody's healthcare record that they in their heart know what the problem is. So let's be serious and let's be real. The other thing that concerns me probably more is the bias that these systems bring in. And there was a study, I think, out of Stanford just recently, who said, boy, bias is in there, both gender, race. We got to be really careful of that. And when you talk about gender and race, the other thing you have to think about is the economics of the population that you're serving. So we got to make sure it's transparent. We can't be saying, oh, because you are of a low economic stature and you live in a rural area, you get X. Whereas if I live in a suburb of Pittsburgh, which I do, I get Y. So let's be careful. Let's start to look. Let's make it so that we all understand what we're getting and how much it's going to cost. And then we can do cost benefit at the level that we need.
I wanted to get your perspective on another step the government's done for rural hospitals, which has generated some, I think, some concerns from some folks with the rural emergency hospital designation, where basically, in some cases, rural hospitals are basically just moving to basically emergency departments and outpatient care. They're just moving away from inpatient care under their new designation from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Not a lot of hospitals have embraced that model or gone that route yet. And I think some have expressed concerns like, well, why would we take even more services away from areas that are already struggling for services? Then other folks say, well, this is why at least preserve some care in these rural communities. What are your thoughts on the rural emergency hospital designation? I mean, do you think this is a viable solution, at least in some cases, or do you have some concerns?
I get real conflicted when people ask me that question, because having practiced and been exposed to those hospitals, you have to provide more than an emergency triage to really provide medical care in an acute setting. I mean, it's just a fact. You can't transport everybody to a major medical center when they have something that can be taken care of in 2 or 3 or 4 days of an inpatient stay with a lower level of care. Why would you want to do that? Because you introduce cost. You also introduce that thing I talked about before. All the unmentioned benefits of being local and providing that care locally because of family units and support. If you go to an emergency status only, and off they go if they have to be admitted, all of that will go away. And I don't think that's good care. I just don't. I never have. So let's be careful about shutting down more of these hospitals and making them what I would call glorified aid stations, where you've got an overworked ER physician who's trying to take care of everybody, and then making sure that he gets or she gets the person to the right level of care wherever that needs to be. So that's an undue burden on them as well. So I'm not really a fan of shutting down local care, which is what you're actually talking about.
And you mentioned the support of the family units, because that's one of the things I think if these are basically become, like you said, emergency departments, you know, outpatient care, then, you know, if somebody has to be transferred to an inpatient stay an hour, 2 hours away, that's an awful big burden for spouse, parent, loved one to have to go. If they have to go driving 2 hours each way to see a loved one in a major medical center, that's not feasible for some folks. And if they can't do that, that certainly that support can affect the patient's recovery for sure. So it just feels like that's adding some burdens in some places where already are struggling. And, you know.
Yeah. And I don't think people realize how much influence family has on inpatient patients. Because I've seen it personally, where when a person is in the hospital that's very sick and they have no family around, their recovery is harder. It just is, because all the support they have is in the hospital, which is understaffed sometimes. So we take that away, we're just going to make patient care worse. I think it's going to be detrimental to them. So I'm a real proponent of, when you're treating patients, you got to incorporate the family and all the caregivers and get everybody on the same page, because that's what'll make the patient get better more quickly.
I did want to at least ask a little bit about maternal care, because that's such a hot topic. And in rural hospitals, I mean, a lot of rural hospitals have shut down their obstetric services just because they just simply haven't afforded them, and that's adding a burden on those patients. So, I mean, how concerned are you about maternal care in some of these rural areas as more of these hospitals are closing up their obstetric services?
Well, I think that is probably one of our biggest issues in providing healthcare across the United States, is the influence on maternal care of both politics and cost and risk. Now, people have been having babies for a long time without physicians, thousands of years. And I used to tell that to my medical students, where, you know, when you're in some kind of situation with a pregnant woman, most generally that's going to work out. People are going to have their babies, you're going to take care of them, but the infant mortality is proof of that. I mean, it's gone down since we've gotten more modern with maternal care, but now it's starting to do what? Go up, because that care is not available in that rapid manner that it has been in the past. So that story is yet to really be written. And I don't want to get on a soapbox about politics, but we're going to have to address it sooner or later, because I think what you're going to find is infant mortality is going to go up, maternal mortality is going to go up, because that care is not available at the level it has been for, you know, the last 50 years.
Well, I know we're getting near the end of our window, but what are the thoughts you have in terms of steps that are needed to help make sure that we preserve these rural hospitals that are really just critical to the health of their communities?
Well, I think the first thing to do is realize that they are different. They are not a big medical center. They're different. The way they apply care is different. So once that difference is identified, then you can start to identify the assist points where you can actually go in and help them, whether that be in Medicare reimbursement needs to go up for these rural settings because they're hard, it's a hard time paying all the bills, whether it's recruitment with nursing, with increased nursing programs. I talked about physician increase in primary care. All of those will help. But I think all of that hinges on the fact that these hospitals are different. And we need to recognize that. And the government needs to step in and say, okay, because they are different, we're going to do a few things. I think reimbursement's one of them. I think assisting medical students and nurses getting into rural care is another. So, and it does, I won't think, take it, it's not going to take a lot to turn the tide just a little bit. But first, recognizing the difference is probably the primary step.
Yeah, different, but still very crucial to the health of their communities. So,
absolutely, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Anders, we've reached the end of our time, but thanks so much for taking the time and talking about some of these important issues about rural hospitals and the care of rural patients. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you for listening to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast by Chief Healthcare Executive. You can subscribe to Healthy Bottom Line wherever you get your podcasts. For the latest news and analysis, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. For Chief Healthcare Executive, I'm Ron Southwick. Take care.